loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by my co-host, John Kiriakou. 100 years ago today, an earth-shaking revolution took place in Russia that led to the establishment of the Soviet Union. The existence of the USSR shaped global politics in the 20th century and influenced the socialist movement globally and the movements for national independence and liberation. We'll spend a full hour today discussing the legacy and historical significance of the Russian Revolution. We are joined from Connecticut by Vijay Prashad. He is a professor of international studies at Trinity College, as well as the author of many books, including The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. We're joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor in the political science department at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Party. And we are joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. He is the host of the Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary show. He's also the author of the book Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. You can listen to Eugene every day, Monday through Friday, on 105.5 FM in the Washington area between 2 and 4 p.m. Welcome, Vijay, Jody, and Eugene.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. All around the world today, people are remembering the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, which, of course, took place from the point of view of the Gregorian calendar on November 7th. It was 11 days earlier with the Julian calendar. That revolution was one of a kind. It was very unique, very distinctive. Of course, it was led by socialists and communists, and they said their goal was not simply to have a new ruling power, but to replace an economic system whereby the exploitation of man by man, as it was called then, would be replaced by a communal system, a collective system, a socialist system, on the way to a classless society, on the way towards communism. It was unexpected. It was a profound impact on the end of World War One. What we want to talk about in the first segment is how this why this revolution happened. What were the factors that led to it? And secondly, what was its impact on global politics at the time? And it's also its impact on the world socialist movement, because it was the first time socialists were taking power and holding the power. Vijay, let's start with you. Why did this revolution happen?
The first revolution in February was against the Tsar and his autocracy, perhaps the most wicked empire in the world at the time. 81% of the peasants in Russia were basically smallholders, largely illiterate, sent off to fight a war that they were not interested in. And the rumblings of their discontent had been running for about 20 years. So that revolution was quite expected and important. During the course of 1917, the Bolshevik group, the group that would become the Communist Party, led by Vladimir Lenin, observed the government of Alexander Kerensky and saw that it was betraying the hopes of the February Revolution. In other words, it was capitulating to global imperialism. It was not prepared to end that wretched war. It was not prepared to turn over land to 81% of the peasants who were landless. And so in October and November of 1917, Lenin and the Bolsheviks conducted an insurrection, not a coup d'etat, but an insurrection to redeem, to protect the revolution of February 1917 and to drive it forward. This revolution, in a sense, delivered the massive Russian Empire to its people and founded the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Jody Dean, let's turn to you. After the Russian Revolution, of course, we could see that during 1917, there was the original February Revolution that Vijay talked about. The main goal of that revolution, or of the people who led the revolution, and it was started by women on International Women's Day. It was a spontaneous event. It wasn't led by the Bolsheviks or the Mensheviks or the SRs. It was the people. Of course, they had been impacted by those political parties. But the demands that they had were for land, bread, and peace, which were also the demands of the Bolshevik Party. Mainly, they wanted to end the war. They wanted to get Russia out of the war. And the problem, it seemed, for the provisional government, for the Kerensky government, because of its international alliances, was incapable of ending the war. And as a consequence, the suffering of the people just wouldn't stop. In other words, there became a new revolutionary government, but a kind of paralysis affecting or infecting that government that made it unable to resolve this problem because of its ties to the West. Do you see it that way?
Yes. What's so interesting about the period following the February Revolution is the inability of the Kerensky government to lead at all, right? So we have, during this time, a period of dual power where the more and more power is shifting over to the Soviets. And in many ways, the Soviets are emerging relatively spontaneously. They had already a history from the 1905 revolution and earlier in Russian history. But more and more, they start to be a place where groups of workers and peasants and soldiers are taking matters into their own hands and self-organizing to deal with the real problems that the Kerensky government simply can't handle. So throughout that summer, you have the just increased failure of the Kerensky government to deal with the situation of the front, the fact that Russia is taking an incredible number of losses, the fact that there are more and more desertions of soldiers who are then pouring into the cities, and they're not able to eat. The production starts to decline. Food, you've got more and more food crises. And then you have particularly in July, a whole great period of violence. And one of the other things that's interesting is how for most of the summer, the different socialist parties actually don't want to take power, right? Like, they're like, oh, it's not our turn. It's supposed to be Bolshevik. I mean, it's supposed to be a bourgeois form of government right now. There's the bourgeoisie supposed to lead. It's not really up to us. But oh my God, the bourgeoisie is too weak and Kerensky is not able to do anything and society is collapsing around us. So in many ways, it's like the social situation pushes the Bolsheviks so that they have to have an insurrection. It's not like they began by saying that's what we're going to do. It's like the situation compelled them because of the incredible amount of instability in the country. And one of the most sort of frustrating and upsetting things about the history that follows is the failure of the European socialist to acknowledge this, to respect this, to recognize this, and to lead revolutions of their own, right? Instead, and then, of course, the fact that the United States, along with Britain, fails to recognize this as a real people's struggle and then pursues their own military aggression in the east of the country and propaganda efforts in Petrograd and Moscow.
Eugene, it's very interesting what Jody's talking about here. Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, those who wrote the Communist Manifesto, and of course Lenin and all of the socialists in Russia were their disciples. Marx and Engels certainly would have anticipated that the socialist revolution would happen in Germany, perhaps, or France. In other words, in an advanced capitalist country, where the means of production were already highly developed, literacy was high, not just in the reading and writing, but in all fields. In other words, the conditions would be laid for society to take the next step and collectivize an already developed, highly developed means of production. But as Jody's mentioning, Russia is emerging really from the throes of feudalism and the legacy of underdevelopment, the retardation of capitalist development. And so, as Lenin said, I think at the time, we had the revolution, surprisingly, not because we thought we were the best equipped, but we were the, quote, weakest link in the imperialist chain. In other words, not where socialism was best suited, but where capitalism was in greatest crisis. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point, and it takes nothing more than a brief look at some of the brief sketches of what socialism would look like from Marx and Engels to get a sense of what you are saying. And I think it was, it's interesting. In retrospect, I think it makes a lot of sense that the imperialist system would break at the weakest link in the chain, not perhaps the most logical place for socialism to develop. But I think at the time, it was a great surprise to many people. But what I will say is, because of that, well, I'll say two things. One, to some degree, Marx anticipated at the end of his life that something like this was possible. There's the famous letter that he wrote between him and Vera Zaslutsch, who was a Russian, about this issue, about perhaps there could be a different way coming through the traditional mirror. But so the perspicacity of Marx there deserves to be mentioned. But that being said, I think it had an interesting sort of reverse effect here, because then you had all these people who were in a similar situation, heavily peasant, feudal type countries, really victimized by imperialism and colonialism, who all of a sudden saw, well, wait a second, perhaps there is a way that we can free ourselves from these methods in the same way that the Soviets had, which resulted in a mass explosion of communism and Marxism in different places around the world. Of course, most famously, Mao Zedong and his compatriots became Marxists because of what happened in the USSR. The African Blood Brotherhood here in the United States, which was the leading edge of black radicalism, and it deserves to be said here, even though he later changed his opinion of the Russian Revolution, A. Philip Randolph, because of his initial association and positivity with the Russian Revolution and against the war of World War I and the Wilson Entry, is heavily demonized, called the most dangerous Negro in the United States. The creation of the Communist Party of South Africa at the time that all around the world, the Soviet Union became a beacon to those in oppressed and exploited nations around the world as an example for them to follow, to believe that they themselves could be free and could be liberated, even without all these things that they were told made them uncivilized or unworthy or needing of the tutelage of European and American powers for all those years, that none of those things were any longer necessary. And I think we see over the course, and I'm sure we'll talk about this here, of the 20s and the 30s, the existence of the Soviet Union as a center of organization for this kind of colonial struggle. So an interesting piece.
A quick question for Vijay, and this is coming from a layman, Vijay. When Marx was writing Das Kapital, he had in mind economies that were already either industrialized or semi-industrialized. And communism really took hold in agrarian societies and then moved east into other agrarian societies. Why was it that it caught on in these agrarian societies like Russia and later China, for example, rather than catching on in Germany, France, and England, where Marx had originally intended?
Well, I think, John, here the role of Lenin is very important. You know, Lenin, as he said himself, said that the living soul of Marxism is its creative application. And if you look at Lenin's career, he was firstly very closely tied to the rank and file in the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Even in exile, he used to keep very close touch with the couriers. He was very interested in knowing what was happening at factory gates, at the periphery of the cities. He was interested in the fact that so many of the industrial workers were themselves one step away from rural areas. And one of his major first books, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, is about the countryside, where Lenin demonstrates a couple of very important points, one of which is that after the 1905 revolution, but this is, of course, his work comes before that, but he sees that these capitalist forces are developing into Russia. And as I was going to say, after the revolution of 1905, this capitalist force into agriculture deepens through the Stolypin reforms. And you see more differentiation in the countryside. And here Lenin begins to theorize the development of a kind of agricultural or agrarian proletariat, a proletariat of the countryside. And he posits the theory that in so-called peasant societies, you cannot follow Marx rigidly. In other words, there needs to be a creative application of the basic methodology of Marxism. And he shows that in these peasant societies, an alliance of the workers and the peasants is essential. Without that alliance, the vast bulk of the population will be outside a revolutionary movement. This theory, I think, is very helpful for the Bolsheviks, who are out there, therefore, able to provide some sort of better, more realistic understanding of the Russian reality. It also draws in the peasantry later into their struggle. I just want to give you very quickly an analogy to show why this is important. In the Tahrir revolution in Egypt, it was largely an urban revolt. There was very little roots in rural areas. There was no theoretical understanding of the peasant basis of Egyptian society. There was no call given for worker-peasant unity. And therefore, when the military decided to crack down on the urban revolt, the rural soldiers didn't defect to the revolt. They stayed with the military. So this theoretical, advance made by Lenin enabled the Russian Revolution because it produced this unique alliance between the workers and the peasants.
Jody Dean, let's just stay with that. It's a really important subject because after the Russian Revolution, the socialist movement goes further and further to the east, or what we now call the Global South, rooting itself there. You had the Chinese Revolution, Mao Zedong and the other young Chinese nationalists and activists, those fighting for both the resumption of China's rightful place in the world, but also fighting for social justice. They become communists. They form a small communist party. Lenin not only was studying the agrarian issue and the issue of a worker and peasant, in other words, small farmer alliance, but also upholding through the slogan of the right of nations to self-determination. In other words, banding with those who are struggling against colonialism or semi-colonialism, or in the case of China, the humiliation of China imposed by Western countries. But it could not have been a revolution without the countryside, without the peasantry. In 1917, the peasants were already storming the estates. They were seizing the land. They were in revolution themselves because they couldn't feed themselves in the war. The magnitude of the violence in the war have just ripped the old society apart. And sort of the genius of the Bolsheviks and Lenin's leadership was to say, yes, we are with you. And he always maintained that as a principal need of the Bolsheviks to retain that alliance between two classes that had, while they were both working classes, they had different sort of social goals. Go ahead.
On that note, one of the things that I find most accurate and insightful regarding Lenin's commitment to a combined struggle of the working class and the peasantry comes from the Hungarian Marxist Gyorgy Lukács, where he says that one of the things that Lenin did was take a notion of the people, right, a kind of older notion of the people that was either blurry or too much, you know, allied to something like a nation state. And he took the notion of the people and he made it into an analysis of the revolutionary alliance of the oppressed, where the term the people then for Lenin starts to mean a revolutionary group, a revolutionary group that will have diverse classes in it, like the proletariat and like the peasantry, and that this revolutionary people as a revolutionary alliance of the oppressed can be a force of revolution. And I think that's one of Lenin in particular's major contributions, right? I mean, he was not a dogmatic Marxist thinking that, oh, just because Marx wrote it 50 years earlier, this is now going to be a blueprint for revolution. Revolution's not like that. We learned that also from Mao, right? Revolution's not a dinner party. It requires flexibility, and it also requires a kind of firm commitment and ability to see things through and be flexible when necessary. So I think that those are some of Lenin's key contributions. I want to add the crucial part of the right to self-determination comes from Lenin's analysis of imperialism. And the fact that he was looking at the function of capitalism as imperialism also enabled him to push forward a view of revolution that would be inspiring across the globe.
That's the voice of Jody Dean. We're also joined by Vijay Prashad and Eugene Puryear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we're talking about the Russian Revolution 100 years later. Today is the anniversary of the October Revolution, which actually takes place, according to our calendar, on November 7th. We're joined from Connecticut by Vijay Prashad. He is a professor of international studies at Trinity College, the author of many books, and the author of the most recent book, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. We're joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor in the Political Science Department at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and her latest book is Crowds and Party. And we are joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. He is an author and activist. He's also the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary. Before we went to the break, we were talking about why the Russian Revolution happened and its immediate impact. In this segment, I want to focus more of our attention on the emergence of the Soviet Union into a global power because of what happened in World War II and the role of the Soviet Union in the defeat of Nazism. And that, of course, broke apart at the end of the war, the U.S. Soviet-British alliance, the wartime alliance. Maybe most Americans don't know that the United States was in an alliance with the Soviet Union. But that alliance ended, and what developed afterwards during the next 40 years was what we call the Cold War. Before we start this, though, Eugene, I want to just remind the audience, in case we don't know or they don't know, that at the time of the Russian Revolution, the entire Western capitalist world, all of the quote, ruling classes of the world, tried to destroy the Russian Revolution. They thought they would destroy it, as Winston Churchill said, aspirationally, we wanted to and tried to strangle the Soviet infant in its crib before it could really get on its feet. They sponsored a civil war, 14 armies invaded, as I mentioned, 3.5 million people in Russia died during those years after World War I. The country lay in ruins at the end by 1920-21. But yet, 20 years later, the Soviet Union emerged as a major power. And let's just frame that. I mean, talk about the role, Eugene, of the Soviet Union and why it could be that this country that had laid in ruins in 1920 could be such a major, perhaps the dominant factor in the defeat of Nazism. And then I want to turn to Vijay and Jody and talk about what that Cold War really was.
Yes. Well, economically, quite remarkable to think that a country that, as you stated, was not only left in ruins from war, but as we discussed in the last segment, was also considered, I hate to use the word, but a quote unquote backward nation in the context of the world, that in, you know, 20, 30 years, they were able to reach a level of development industrially that put them at least in the same league, if you will, with many of the Western nations. And I think that it's 100% clear that it was because of the nature of the organization of the country on a socialist basis, which has a lot of different sort of pieces to it. You have war communism, you have the new economic policy, you have the period of the rapid industrialization in the late 20s and the early 30s. So a lot of things to discuss and parse throughout that. But I think what is, you know, sort of central to that key piece is the role of centralized planning. The idea that, and this is sort of the traditional Marx, and not sort of, it is the traditional Marxist idea that under capitalism, you have the anarchy of production. People produce things in order to make money, which does require them in the most general sense to meet some needs of some people. But by and large, people are just producing things. There's no real context or discussion of, well, what do we have? What do we need? And, you know, where do we want to go? And what are the elements that we need to get to where we want to go based on what we have and what we need and how do we need to operate? And this was the reality of the Soviet Union. I mean, as you mentioned, Brian, the revolution under the guise of land, peace, and bread, a revolution that was against imperialism and colonialism and desiring of creating a strong, unified state that could provide people with food, shelter, clothing, education. And so you take the things that you have, where you want to go, and the things that you need, and you develop a plan that allows you to use the human material resources that you have in a certain territory in order to organize society in such a way to build up a large, powerful nation that had the ability to produce quite a bit, which is why, of course, there was the unbelievable feat in World War II of the ability of a country that had had almost its entire sort of Western peace, the most developed piece of the country, be invaded and, you know, completely despoiled by the Nazis. The stories we know of thousands of factories taken apart piece by piece by piece and moved to the east of the Ural Mountains and then rebuilt. And I want to just touch on one other thing, too. The spirit of the Soviet people to develop themselves. You know, there's a great book called The Other Side of the Hill by B.H. Liddell Hart, who is the number one sort of tank expert in the world. He was a UK general. And after the war, he goes to Germany and interviews all these German generals about fighting the Soviet Union on the Eastern Front. And one of the generals tells a story about the Battle of, I believe it's Moscow. It could be Stalingrad. I don't have the book in front of me, so just forgive me. But the story itself speaks to it. And the general was like, yeah, you know, we almost won. But at one point where we had, I think it was Moscow, breached the city in one of the factory districts, and they thought they were just going to sweep into the place, the workers came out of the factories with hammers and beat back the Nazi onslaught. And I think that in and of itself speaks to a huge piece of this, oh, well, the Soviet Union was just this big, dark night of terrible human beings under the iron boot of Stalin, and everyone was just cowering in a little hovel in the corner with a little candle. People with that kind of mentality who will come out of a factory with hammers to fight someone to defend their own country are not those type of people. So certainly I think the socialist system, central planning, which allowed them to harness resources in a way that capitalist economies cannot do, which I think there are other countries right now that speak to that. But I think over and above that, the revolutionary spirit of Soviet people to say, yes, we made this great revolution. Yes, we now have created this entity that we believe can liberate us, and we will fight to defend it no matter what.
A question for Vijay. The New York Times reported this week in an article about the anniversary of the revolution, and I quoted here, they say that without the revolution, there would have been no Hitler. And without Hitler, there would have been no Mao. And the entire, what they call rapture of human history would have changed. Is that true? And even if it is true, Vijay, does it matter in the context of the Cold War?
Well, that's absurd rather than true. I mean, you know, I'd like to have the other sequence of names on the table. How would we explain King Leopold of Belgium, who massacred half the population of the Congo? What is the genesis of his brutality? How do we understand the genesis of the British royal family and its brutality, not only in India, where it was, horrendous. Millions, tens of millions died in the famine of commission in the 1880s. I mean, this is the way the bourgeois press wants us to basically defend this revolution on the back foot. You know, they would like us, whoever, you know, wants to talk about the Russian Revolution, to always come to the question of Stalin, to always come to the question of the purges, to, in fact, denigrate the Russian Revolution based on that history. I mean, as Eugene was just saying, you know, the importance of the Soviet Union was key during World War II. I mean, it's outrageous for the New York Times to make that comment because, in fact, without the Soviet Union, fascism might have triumphed in Europe. I mean, it was the Soviet Union that defeated fascism to the cost of perhaps 28 million people dead fighting against the fascist enemy. I mean, it was the Soviet Union that liberated Germany before the Europeans did, before the British did and the Americans did, and so on. So these are ridiculous ways of approaching what is really quite an important world historical event. It is true, of course, that there were great distortions inside the Soviet Union. It is true that they made many errors in the way of democracy, in the fusing of the party and the state, not allowing the party to continue as an external body. But even here, there are, as it were, I think, important historical reasons why that happened. I mean, we see this in most parties today. You know, there is a tendency when a political party comes to power to send some of its best people into the state. And when that happens, the party suffers. This is precisely what happened in the USSR. It is also the case that there is a tendency to denigrate democracy, to try to centralize power. You have this not just in the Soviet Union, you have this in the United States. The issue is to create institutional policies that prevent democracy from being stifled, that prevent authoritarian tendencies from coming to power. This is a common human problem that all systems have to deal with. This is not a specifically socialist or communist problem. So I read these kind of statements, John, and I roll my eyes and I say, you know, it's all very well for them to try to denigrate this history because, after all, they are afraid of its consequences. They don't want the kind of values of this history to assert themselves in the present.
Jody Dean, there's the label, the imprimatur of the Cold War, leaves a lot to be desired because the Cold War wasn't so cold, say, in Korea. 4 million Koreans died. It wasn't so cold in Vietnam. Millions of Vietnamese people died liberating their countries. You can go through so many places around the world where the Cold War, these two social systems that faced off, took place. The war between nations, even in the case of Korea, also, you know, in many ways represented a struggle between classes because you had the South Korean government, which had been a construct of U.S. occupation following the Japanese occupation that ended in September 1945. In fact, the Americans insisted the Japanese stay in place after the surrender by the emperor in August 15th until the Americans could show up and take over Southern Korea. It was a struggle between nations, but also in many ways representing a struggle between classes in the form of a struggle between nations. And you had the Soviet Union sort of supporting, and in the most part, not always, but in the most part, all of those who were fighting against Western capitalism or its elites that had been imposed on peoples in different countries around the world. And on the contrary, you had the United States and the Western powers supporting just the opposite side, those who were fighting. From your point of view, how would you characterize that period of history, the Cold War? What was it?
I think the Cold War should be understood as a period of capitalist reaction to the strength of the proletarian revolution in the Soviet Union, right? And if we think of the United States as ground zero of capitalism, then the U.S. was doing everything that it could to block any kind of further success for national liberation and working class struggle all over the world. So that was its primary goal. And the U.S. does this. I mean, it's essentially justifying its own imperialism by demonizing everything that happens that's not completely in accordance with its will as essentially some kind of Soviet plot. And it also happens at home, right? I mean, I don't know how many younger Americans really remember or are really taught about the strong legacy of anti-communism in the United States, right? From the 1947 hearings from the House Committee on Un-American Activities, where there's this Hollywood 10 blacklist and all sorts of people are essentially demonized and kicked out of the industry as communists. Paul Robeson, Orson Welles, Charlie Chaplin. I'm not sure how many people realize that Communist Party leaders in the United States were put on trial for violating the Smith Act, really highly publicized trials that led to Supreme Court decisions. I mean, and all of these different defendants, like 11 of them in 1949, are convicted of conspiring to overthrow the U.S. government, even though that's not what they were doing at all, right? They were simply organizing as communists to make sure that people understood what communism is, that it's possible to arrange an economy not based on profit, but for the benefit of workers, that there is another way, and yet these people are put in jail. I'm not sure how many people realize exactly how pernicious the McCarthy Permanent Senate Subcommittee on Investigations was. That usually gets the most attention, the McCarthy era. But people may have forgotten that communism was made illegal, right? The 1954 Communist Control Act made membership in the Communist Party and support for any communist activities a criminal offense. And now some of these rules have been made, have been rendered unconstitutional, but they're still on the books in lots of different states, right? Even last year in Brooklyn, a school principal was investigated for communist activities. So this legacy of capitalism's fear, a working class being strong, a fear of national liberation struggles, a fear that, oh, when people realize that together they can actually organize, push back, and produce an economy that meets their needs. Capitalism is really afraid of that, and it has done historically for over 100 years everything it can to squash this.
I think Jody's right. In my hometown of New Castle, Pennsylvania, there was a scandal just recently because a young man who graduated from the military academy at West Point took off his cap at graduation, and he had a photo of Che Guevara inside the cap. He's a kid. He expressed support for the philosophy behind Che Guevara and was suspended from the U.S. military pending an investigation. He didn't do anything. He didn't say anything. He just showed a photograph. But there's such fear of communism. There's such fear of this philosophy that this man's now not allowed to serve in the U.S. military.
Yeah, this kind of anti-communism, Eugene, as Jody is pointing out, became the dominant ideology in the United States following World War II. And anybody who was on the left was branded. Anti-communism became sort of an unofficial religion. It's had a big impact, and yet in fact, the ideas of socialism still keep reviving, even though it's coming out of, in the United States at least, a bitter period of anti-communism.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, but and I want to touch that. But, you know, reversing back, I think it's really important also to recognize the Cold War was not preordained, that there is sort of a battle of ideas, if you will. I wanted to read something here from very prominent New York Times correspondent right at the time, writing in the late 40s here, talking about the opinion of various American diplomats about what was going on at the time in the rise of the Cold War. The momentum of pro-Soviet feeling worked up during the war to support the Grand Alliance had continued too heavily after the armistice. This made it difficult for the administration to carry out the stiffer diplomatic policy required now. For this reason, these observers believe a campaign was worked up to obtain a better psychological balance of public opinion. It's very important to recognize people as august as General Dwight D. Eisenhower, General Beadle, who was also prominent in World War II, Mr. Forrestal, who in his own diaries laid this out, Herbert Hoover, no Bolshevik there. All were saying at the time, there is no danger of war with Russia. We should not push a danger of war with Russia. Of course, the former Vice President Henry Wallace, which, as an interesting parenthetical aside, there is a massive British spy campaign in America to try to sideline Henry Wallace and what he represented of a world alliance between the United States and the Soviet Union that embraced peace and non-colonial realities around the world, that this was a campaign that was directly targeted here and to win people over to push these ideas. And the International Workers' Order, a Jewish fraternal organization with millions of dollars in insurance, completely and totally destroyed. The unions that were the most powerful unions for workers' rights, completely destroyed. The United Electrical Workers. People in D.C. who are listening to this know about the Hatch Act. Why is there a Hatch Act? Because the United Public Workers, a black-led union that was especially empowering the role of black female workers and raising up around that new theoretical constructs about how black women understand themselves, the so-called triple oppression that Claudia Jones and other black leftists were putting out, completely destroyed and the Hatch Act put in to make impossible for these government workers to continue to organize. The National Negro Labor Councils, the civil rights movement was probably set back maybe 10 years really, by what happened in McCarthyism. I mean, really unbelievably criminal. But I'll say finally here, too, parenthetically, about why it continues to revive. Something that VJ mentioned in the very beginning, I think, speaks to that when he mentioned the development of capitalism in Russia, Lenin's book, where he says parenthetically in a footnote that he believes black people in the United States are a nation within a nation, a theme that is a recurring theme across the black liberation movement. And I think it's not that surprising to figure out why Leninism, as it were, has always been traditionally embraced by many individuals in the black liberation movement because of this connection between national development, national liberation, and freedom from oppression. So I think the underlying philosophy continues to be relevant to many different people.
That's the voice of Eugene Puryear. We're talking to Vijay Prashad and Jody Dean on the anniversary of the Russian Revolution. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we're talking about the Russian Revolution 100 years later. Today is the anniversary. We're joined from Connecticut by Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College, as well as the author of the book, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, and the author of many other books. We're joined from Geneva, New York by Jody Dean. She is a professor in the political science department at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her latest book is Crowds and Parties. And we are joined in studio by Eugene Puryear, co-host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary. Jody Dean, let's pick up where Eugene left off before the break. And then we're going to talk about what's happened to world politics after the fall of the Soviet Union. Go ahead.
So Eugene was making such important points about the intertwining of the struggle for black liberation in the United States and the Bolshevik Revolution. And I wanted to connect this actually with the first Red Scare already in 1919, because the Cold War wasn't, as Eugene said, wasn't necessary. It also wasn't new. Already in 1919, as American troops were coming back to from the front, there was a great deal of social upheaval. And in part, this was because a number of black troops had experienced more freedom when they were in Europe than they had in the United States and were tired of the oppression that they were encountering. Yet when they got to the U.S., they did not receive a hero's welcome. Instead, there was a wave of anti-Black violence, a wave that included lynchings throughout the summer in the South. I mean, even in the South that summer, there were burning of African-Americans at the state authorized by the governor, who said, well, you know, necessary arrangements have been made to make sure the mob wouldn't go too far, even as 3,000 people came out to watch someone being burned alive. Now, this wave of violence was widely covered in the Black press, who were urging each other to oppose lynch law with cold steel and fire and to fight back. But what happens? The white mainstream media, the white press blames the Bolsheviks. So the whites blame Russia for their United States' own problems, right? There were headlines like Red Stir Negroes to Revolt. They claimed that all of the problems came from Russia, that they were financed by Russia, rather than these being real indications of a struggle that was already going on in the United States.
Vijay Prashad, before we get to the last segment, I want to stay with this. I think it's an extremely important part of what's going on. There was the Palmer raids at that time. 10,000 socialists were arrested. Many immigrants were deported. And as Jody and Eugene are saying, the demonization of Black soldiers who were demanding to, you know, not live under apartheid after they had fought in World War One, didn't want to come back after being, you know, first class soldiers to become second class citizens once again. We have just a few blocks from where we are in Washington, D.C., the Howard Theater right there. Black soldiers who had returned took up sniper posts and shot at and dispersed white mobs that were beating and killing Black people in the middle of downtown Washington, D.C. That happened all over the country. I mean, it's completely right. And we have the same situation going on now where even today's witch hunt against Russia, post-Soviet Russia, the same sort of accusations that Russia's behind all of the, quote, social divisiveness, including support for the Black Lives Matter movement, which is just absurd. But anyway, there is this toxic intertangling of anti-communism and racism and scapegoating, and it just hasn't stopped. It seems to be part of the DNA of American bourgeois political psychology. Go ahead.
Well, you know, for 70 years in the United States, there's been a propaganda campaign against the Soviet Union, which was understood to be Russia. Although, you know, it needs to be said that the Soviet Union is not coterminous with Russia. The Soviet Union at its highest point was a union of several nationalities whose social development was taken very seriously by the Soviet government. So many of them were, you know, had alphabets produced where previously they were denied the ability to read and write. But nonetheless, this propaganda against Russia was quite phenomenal for 70 years. So it's very difficult for people to get this out of their skin, get this out from under their skin. And when became perhaps valuable to mobilize this, you know, disdain for Russia, fear of Russia, whatever you consider it, it was brought into the picture. I mean, yes, it's true that the Russian government has produced, you know, media outlets of various kinds. Yes, it's true that people in Russia are interested in the United States. But this does not or should not take away from the fact that for over the last 100 years, the United States has been intervening in other people's politics. The United States has been openly overthrowing governments. The United States has its own international media, previously very strongly government-backed. Now you don't need to back it by the government. It's basically backed by capitalists who share the same interests as the government. So, you know, this idea of old fears being mobilized once again, I think is something people should pay attention to. So rather than fall prey to this fear-mongering, I think it's a good idea to test that old organ that sits somewhere north of, you know, of the mouth, which we call the brain.
Eugene Perrier, after the Soviet Union collapsed, I mean, because communism and socialism became conflated with a state, with a government, and when that government imploded, collapsed, was overthrown, I don't think we have time to talk about the different dynamic and the factors that were happening within the summits of the Soviet system. Obviously, that's an important subject. But nonetheless, it changed the balance of forces in the world. Before the United Soviet Union was aligned with, say, Iraq or Syria, they were, even though they were not ideologically aligned with Iran following the Islamic Revolution of 1979, all over the world, the Soviets acted as something of a counterweight, a major counterweight to U.S. hegemony. I remember listening to a discussion with an ambassador from Mozambique who said, after the Soviet Union collapsed, people were rude to us. I mean, Americans. Like, in other words, they would tell us, shut up, you know, things like that. In other words, the balance of force has shifted. And it seems to me that the United States became consumed with this kind of triumphalism, this idea that the U.S. had no rival that could challenge it. And there was going to be the new unipolar American world, the end of history, et cetera. Talk about how this has impacted politics, and especially because we talked about how it impacted the Russian Revolution, impacted Asia and Africa and the Middle East, how it's the absence of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think it's a very relevant point. And I think the most obvious examples of this are the destruction that we saw of Iraq and Libya, which certainly never could have happened given their relationship to the Eastern Bloc countries. And I think that is the reality, is that the United States went to this unipolar world and there was no military, financial, trade balance weight in terms of the world relationship of forces. I mean, when you look at the African countries that took up socialism in the post-colonial period, you know, many of them continued to have relationships with the West without massive interruption, because they had, you know, traditionally been locked into these colonial relationships, but there was no way they were going to be able to, even though they tried in many different ways, overthrow these countries. And many of the European nations were forced to come to terms with the fact that there was, you know, going to be socialist governments in Africa, and they would just have to figure out how they were going to do business with them. I think that ultimately there were many countries, you know, Cuba, for instance, that was able to mitigate for many years the impact of the embargo by the trade relationship they had with the Eastern Bloc countries, and then that was lost. And I think perhaps more than anything else, and this is the most relevant to me, is it created a very difficult dynamic for popular movements looking to emerge on the scene and to govern themselves as they so chose. I mean, most formerly socialist states pretty much changed overnight to conform to what Western governments thought they should look like, to show, well, look, you know, you don't need to push in and overthrow us, or, you know, do whatever, we're going to get on side here. And so for those who have, were looking to rise up and to liberate their country, there then was this overhanging reality, well, who do we turn to? Certainly the United States will not support us. And if we are successful on our own in taking power, how will we be able to do anything that breaks from the international financial consensus? I think we can also see in countries like South Africa, the inherent conservatization of the ANC in the context of the fall of the Soviet Union and the loss of confidence of many people within their own high councils about their ability to direct their own path. So I think the idea that a country could develop on their own path because they could either ally with the Soviet Union, or at the very least balance between the varying powers, was something that was completely lost. And I think, in a historic crime, quite frankly, on the part of the U.S. government and the Western imperialist, to essentially eliminate the idea of national independence for a decade and a half, because now they felt that they had no rival to check them.
But Eugene, isn't it true, though, that some, in some countries, that may be coming back? I can tell you that in Greece, the Syriza government is not a capitalist government. Some would call it socialist. Some would say that it's socialist with some communists, and it's actually working and putting people back to work. There are non-Soviet, what they call Euro-communist parties that are ascendant in places like Italy, France, even Spain. Don't you think that in the post-Soviet era, Some parties, especially in Western Europe, are realizing that there is an alternative to capitalism? It doesn't have to be Soviet communism, but it can still be communist.
Well, I think that's a great point, and I think you're right, and I'd add some of the quote-unquote pink-tide countries in Latin America, and I think we can relate this directly to what happened to the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I think finally busted this myth that the U.S. is all-powerful and can control all things and will just barrel over every single person. I think sort of psychologically, the U.S. coming to ruin there was big. And then secondarily, now with the rise of China, and not just China, I mean, I think you could raise many of the ASEAN countries from Thailand to Vietnam to Indonesia that are also rising, and the role that Russia is also playing on the world scale. And really, but principally, I think the rise of China and India as well, there's been a rejiggering of the ability of countries to develop a matrix of nations by which they can develop more on their own terms. You raised the Syriza government, which, for instance, has been, you know, aggressively pushing relations with China, for instance. And I think that we see that all around the world, that I think psychologically the unipolar world peace was broken by the U.S. just completely failing in the Middle East. And then I think economically we now have a perspective where people feel like, hey, we can do a little bit more of our own thing. And I also think that the problems in the United States, I mean, as you all remember, the Bill Clinton campaign on a peace dividend, right? And everything was going to be great. And the United States internally has not been able to resolve many of its own problems in the context of a post-Soviet world where a lot of people thought maybe they'd draw down the military and have more of a social democracy, which I think has also discredited a lot of what's happening here and opened up new horizons.
Vijay, go ahead. Jump in if you would.
Well, I mean, in my opinion, the collapse of the Soviet Union has been catastrophic, first for the peoples of the Soviet Union. Their health indicators, standard of living has deteriorated. There were severe problems in the first decade after the counter-revolution against October, led by people as disparate on the one side as Mr. Gorbachev and Yeltsin. So for the very peoples of that territory, it has been catastrophic. For the world, I think it has been a terrible loss. You know, capitalism has had a 500-year-plus history. It has a history of, you know, various great crimes and some important advances. Soviet Union was only allowed to survive for 70 years. You know, when Trotsky was sitting in Turkey writing his superb history of the Russian Revolution, he said, you know, you want to condemn us before we've even learned how to walk. And I think that judgment must be taken seriously even after the 70 years of the Soviet Union. It's a very short period of time. At the recent Party Congress in China, Xi Jinping spoke about, you know, hundreds of years, you know, before you can judge the standard of the Chinese Revolution. He said, let's see what will happen in 2049. I mean, you know, this is the scale, at the time scale at which the Chinese are thinking. And we should remember that. When we look back and see that the Soviet Union wasn't even allowed to last for 100 years.
Jody Dean, your reaction. We're talking about the impact of the loss of the Soviet Union on world politics and on the different peoples inside of course, the former USSR. But again, its impact has been global. Go ahead.
I agree with Vijay. I think that the impact has been catastrophic. And I think primarily the reason it's been so catastrophic is it has made it seem, I think at least superficially in the mainstream, that Margaret Thatcher was right when she said there is no alternative to capitalism. And so the struggle for the left across the globe has now been to defeat that mindset, which is backed by military power, to defeat that mindset that there is no alternative to capitalism, and to show that there can be a large-scale global system that is anchored in equality, respect, self-determination, and the abolition of exploitation. So I think that the collapse of the Soviet Union or the defeat of the Soviet Union has been extremely detrimental that way for as we try to move forward in light of something like a communist horizon. I'll also say on a shorter time scale, I think it's been very hard for the left in the so-called global north, because too many people don't know what they're fighting for, right? I mean, is it for like a kinder, gentler capitalism, right? Which is usually just capitalism that's a little nicer for us, even as people in other countries are more and more exploited. I mean, everybody can recognize that that's an utterly untenable, you know, politically and ethically situation, but yet it's been been very, very hard for the left to recover and to be able to say what it stands for and fight for that. So I think that our challenge for, say, the next 100 years is to, you know, recall the lessons, the victories, and actually the sense of political will and possibility that the Bolsheviks opened up.
Okay, we have less than 3 minutes. I want to have each of you address the exact same question. We started this show, what was its impact on the left and the socialist movement back then, 100 years ago? Of course, social movements are breaking out, but Jody Dean, Eugene said, people have to know what they're fighting for. Let's take a minute for each of you.
Yes. Well, I think that what Jody is saying is 100% correct. And I think that that's what we're seeing now is a growing struggle, I think, across the North and across the South of people looking to redefine what they are fighting for, to build new movements and to continue to push forward. We see things like, you know, mass protests sweeping West Africa under the spirit of Thomas Sankara, the well-known socialist leader of Burkina Faso in the 1980s. We're seeing here in the United States a revival of revolutionary thought and ideas. We're seeing deep and I think very substantive discussions coming out of what's taking place in China. And that's just like, you know, the tip of the iceberg right now. So I think that we're in a process now of that kind of redefinition and growth of a socialism in the 21st century.
Vijay Prashad, go ahead.
Well, I should say up front that I'm a member of the Communist Party of India Marxist, which has 1 million members and, you know, has grown from strength to strength. But also our fights have been largely defensive. We have been fighting against the right. The right has been on the offensive. The right has been driving history off the cliff. So our fights have been largely defensive. There's a lot to oppose and very little time. I think what's important for us is to be out there thinking about what kind of alternatives we are looking for. It's not enough to have an empty slogan like another world is possible. We have to say what that world is going to look like. We need some concrete footholds. We need to be quite bold in our understanding. We need to be imaginative within what we're saying. We should not allow ourselves, even though we have to, we should not allow ourselves to become defensive and involuted. We need to be imaginative. We need to be bold. I think we need to be courageous in standing up, not only for our values, but for the kind of policies we would like to see in a future world.
Okay, 15 seconds, Jody Dean.
For the next 100 years, the global socialist and communist left has to look forward. Climate change is one of the most pressing issues on the agenda. If we don't collectively push on that and come together on that, then there won't be a future.
All right. That was Jody Dean. We've also been joined by Vijay Prashad and Eugene Puryear. After a short break, we'll be talking about the big stories of today. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.